The Tom Woods Show, episode 911.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're like me, one of your favorite things in the world is being on Facebook and encountering supporters of government health care who assume you probably just want children to die. Yes, hectoring and moralizing on Facebook about health care. It's an epidemic. Well, my new ebook comes to the rescue. Absolutely free. It's called Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Healthcare. Grab your free copy at yourfriendsarewrong.com. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. I guess this is probably a short-ish episode. I say that all the time, then it always ends up just being an average-length episode. This will be a short-ish episode. I have some audio now from my appearance. This is now a month and a half ago at the Yale Political Union, but I need to set it up for you before you listen to it. First of all, I want you to know my audio guy is on vacation for several days, so today through episode 913, I have a friend filling in who is quite capable, but congratulations to Chris that he's able to take some time off. I want you to know that the audio is not of top quality, and the reason is the microphones weren't working. And also, if you Google, or if you go to YouTube, you type in Yale Political Union, almost nothing comes up, little clips here and there. But they really don't go out of their way to record these things. So they did have an official so-called recording, but it's not much better than what you're about to hear. And that official recording did not include my rebuttals, which are sort of central to the whole thing. The rebuttals, as far as I'm concerned, are the whole thing. Because the format was, I get up there and speak for 20 to 30 minutes in defense of a resolution. And our resolution was in favor of the right of American states to secede and arguing that this was a desirable thing. So I made the case. Then people from all different perspectives, students at Yale, get up and give speeches for or against. And then I get an opportunity to sum up, but also to respond to these particular people, pro and con. And then they take a vote and they see whether the motion carries. And as you'll hear, the motion did carry in favor of state secession, if you can believe that. And they immediately afterward, they always have a motion to thank the speaker for coming. And you can hear there's a resounding second coming from the audience. So that's all good, but the audio quality is not great. But thank goodness we've got it. At least we've got it. It was an amateur recording somebody did from the middle of the crowd, which means that at the beginning you can sort of loudly hear the people right next to that particular recording device, and it also means it's very echoey, and you will miss a little bit here and there. But you can mostly get what's being said. Don't get me wrong here. You can mostly get what's being said. Now, another thing you need to know is that hissing and banging things are customary features of the way the Yale Political Union operates. And the Yale Political Union's been in existence since the 1930s. And they have this tradition whereby if you hear something you disagree with, you, as an audience member, hiss at it. You actually hiss. And if you hear something you agree with, then you bang your seat, or if you're standing next to the wall, you hit the wall, you hit something to indicate your support. So when you start hearing these noises, I don't want you to think, boy, this must have been an unusually contentious evening. This is how it always is. There's hissing and hitting of seats. This is just the way it works. And by the way, there are a couple times when I mention the Iraq War and people hiss. They're not hissing the war. They're hissing my opposition to the war, because there actually were some neocons in the audience. They did not like I was using the Iraq War as an example of what not to do. So now you understand what's going on there. Now, what you can do if you want to hear the entire episode, the entire event, including my opening statement, including the statements by the other people, you can do that because I will have the video of the event from which this audio is drawn up at tomwoods.com/911. Now, you can get a good quality audio overview of my opening statement, really a duplication of my opening statement, is in episode 52 of The Tom Woods Show. And there, it's just me speaking into a microphone. It's pretty much exactly what I said at this event. So you could just get that at tomwoods.com/52. I'll link to that on the show notes page as well. So if you want everything, you can get it at tomwoods.com/911. But for now, I just... So in other words, I'm not going to go into what every argument was that people used against me. You can tell from my replies pretty much what the arguments would have to have been. They were fairly conventional, capital F Federalist-style arguments. There were arguments invoking the "we the people" in the Constitution. There were arguments about the word "perpetual" that was used in the Articles of Confederation, and arguments of that sort. We had somebody get up and say, "Let's see," we had somebody get up and say, "This just seems like kids at a playground taking their ball and going home, and that we have to abide by the will of the majority." I mean, there was one person who actually was at that low of a level. But by and large, the arguments were fairly reasonable. They're about as good as you could get, arguments against secession. There were some arguments in my favor, which was nice to see. There was a guy named Cole Aronson, I actually single out by name, who made an argument. I can't really summarize that well here, but he was basically saying, look, for all the complaints we have, on world historic grounds, we have a lot of freedoms in the U.S., and I'm not sure I want to screw around with that. And that was his argument from Prudence. So I did try to at least briefly answer that, but I think that requires a longer answer. The very last responder said that when you have these small states that have a uniform culture, these tend to be less libertarian than more diverse societies. So I tried to say at least a brief word about that. But I did at one point get somebody who said, "I can't believe we have not talked about slavery." And I thought, oh, man, it's like I planted you in the audience. That is exactly what I wanted you to say. And so at one point, you can hear me saying that this guy is about as wrong can be. So you will enjoy that one. I think I do get rather the better of my opponents, but in, I hope, an engaging style, right? I think even though I didn't persuade everybody, I think I more or less won over the audience just by my demeanor and attitude and my way of speaking. And I started making fun of the very first person who was critical of me was also the person who had arranged the logistics for the event. And so I have a funny joke I make at his expense there that I hope you'll enjoy. So that is that. So go ahead, check this baby out, and I hope you enjoy it, and I'll talk to you again on the other side of this.
All right, I'm going to go quickly because it's late, and that's also an excuse to have really superficial responses. So first one's for Ryan Cash, who called me here, so you'd think I would at least do the decency of not mentioning his terrible arguments. But actually, I'm not sure. Is this done in the spirit of a roast? Because that's how I'm doing it. Anyway, you were quoting some speeches by Lincoln, but you know, just because Lincoln said something, you know, that's just an assertion. I need some meat. And so we were told that if a state secedes, this makes the Union less perfect. That's not self-evident. Why is the Union made less perfect by secession? Would the Union be made more perfect by keeping people in it against their will? What kind of a Union is that? I don't think your arguments could. I don't think you could justify the American Revolution based on your arguments. Warren Stern, not any objection to what she said, but somebody asked a very good question. We have contracts that are not revocable, like for example, a marriage contract in the Catholic Church. That was what the argument was. And so, why couldn't this be another example of it? And the answer, I think, is a very important clarification: is that it's not called the contract theory. And it's the compact theory. The argument is not that the states entered into a contract with the federal government, and now the states have decided to revoke it or get out of the contract. That is not the theory. To the contrary, the federal government is not even a party to it. So it's not like the states got into an agreement with the federal government. The states created the federal government. There was no federal government for them to enter into a contract with. So there's no contract here. There's a compact among the states themselves to establish a central power to carry out certain common functions. But that's all we have. We don't have anything where, well, the federal government and the states, they came to some agreement. Maybe it's unbreakable. It's the states agreed among themselves for their own convenience to do this. Thomas Gould makes the word perpetual play a much... makes it bear a weight that the argument simply cannot bear in his comments. He says the word perpetual appears all over the Articles of Confederation. But bear in mind that the word perpetual in the 18th century in diplomatic language does not mean goes on forever. This is very important. The word perpetual simply meant it lacks a built-in sunset provision. So it could be ended at some point in the future. We simply haven't determined in advance what that meant. So, for that. And to say, well, the Constitution starts with something that undermines Woods' arguments. It starts with we the people. Well, that's true. But the change from we the states to we the people occurred via the Committee on Style at the convention. And then when the change was introduced, there was not one vote in the negative. Now, this had actually been a momentous change, changing the entire nature of the Union. You better believe there would have been votes in the negative. So, to that. Then he says, well, if I'm going to quote from the Declaration of Independence. And that's great. And by the way, he's such an affable guy. I hate to make fun of him. Because, I mean, he's a smart guy. I mean, I see a lot of myself in him when I was his age. I don't mean to be patronizing. But he's an extremely conscientious treasurer. And he's a guy spend money on his dinner. He eats some crummy cafeteria dinner. Then he had nachos tonight. He didn't finish them, so he brought them home. That's a good man. So I don't know. He says, when there's a long train of abuses, then you could maybe think about what he calls rebellion, which of course begs the whole question. It's not rebellion. But my question would be, who gets to decide what constitutes a long train of abuses? If it's the central power, they'll never concede. They're not going to say, oh, you know what, you're right, that's a long list. They'll never allow it. Okay, then, the most interesting comment I thought came from Cole Aronson. I actually don't think I have a really pithy response to it, except I'll take my chances of it not being prudent or maybe with. Now, I still want to do it. I mean, I guess I'm just more pessimistic about the U.S. government and the situation than you are. I feel like nothing we do ever changes anything, and so might as well try something radical. You know, I could die saying I did something. Okay. So then Mr. Sharma talks about, people if a state secedes, people will be deprived of the benefits that they would have had in the Union, namely having their rights protected and stuff. Okay, what about people who want to be protected under the British Empire with the American Revolution? Were they unjustly treated? Should they have resisted and fought back against that? I think that's a double standard. Secondly, does Roe versus Wade justify a world government allowing abortion everywhere? Is my not sarcastic question. Then also, whatever atrocities you think an American state might commit, not one of them in a million years comes anywhere near the war in Iraq, in my opinion. So when I think about which has led to, I mean, who knows how many deaths, 2 to 4 million people displaced, people calling themselves conservatives defending this thing, and stuff. Had divided into 2 or 3 countries. I know that's blasphemy. Suppose they had. Are you sure all 3 of them would have wanted to enter World War I, which is an absolute epic disaster, which accelerated every bad trend in Europe, led to all kinds of problems, including the rise of a certain party I had forsworn to discuss? Would they all have the same foreign policy? I mean, would they all be doing the same stupid crap? Maybe they that would have changed the world for the better, but we can't. We're so stuck in this conventional way of thinking, and we think we're cheeky half the time, when actually we're just boring, conventional thinkers. Think about how the world would be different if there hadn't been some U.S. federal government running the whole damn world all the time. All right, for Mr. Pecht, he's the most affable guy I've met the whole night. All right? But what he said is, I'm just wrong, like wronger, as wrong as wrong can be. This is all about slavery. No, it's not. It's not about slavery. Let's trace it out. Let's trace out the history of states versus the federal government. Yes, it's true, some states have slavery. I know that. But let's go through the history. 1798, The Virginia and Kentucky resolutions are drafted by Jefferson and Madison. They say the states can nullify an unconstitutional federal law. Now, what are they talking about there? Are they talking about the federal government trying to abolish slavery and we have the right to resist that? No. They were talking about New Englanders who basically wanted to make it a crime to criticize the president. People in Virginia were saying, you know, my copy of the Constitution doesn't allow that. And we're going to resist it because this is a federal government of limited powers. That's what it says in the Kentucky resolutions. And the rest of the powers are reserved to the states. We never delegated any power to police our speech. That you couldn't call John Adams a fat ass, which people were calling him, and were being fined in jail for that, including a U.S. congressman. That had nothing to do whatsoever to do with slavery. We don't have to be obsessed constantly. Constantly with race. There are things that have nothing to do with race. The Louisiana Purchase. There was a secession movement in New England that was prompted over that, led by Senator Timothy Pickering. What the heck? What in the world did that have to do with anything, right? It had nothing to do with slavery. So there was a movement over that. When Jefferson launched his embargo at the end of 1807, there was secession talk over that. There was implied secession talk at the Hartford Convention in 1814. The federal government doesn't meet our demands. We will meet again. And everybody knew what that meant. We meet again, you're going to talk about secession. Daniel Webster said that if the federal government tries to engage in military conscription, this would be such an outrage against the Constitution that the states should resist the effort. What does that have to do with slavery? Well, it has to do with slavery that we're not going to enslave people in our nation. But let's say a little something about slavery. It was the federal government that was subsidizing slavery by socializing the cost of chasing after runaways.
Right.
There's no reason northern states should have to pay for that. It's not in their system. What do they possibly benefit from that system? So when the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act of 1818 does not mean that the U.S. government is authorized to do any old thing that it wants to catch runaway slaves. So there were states that thought that was unconstitutional. In Wisconsin, the state legislature quoted from the Kentucky resolutions of Jefferson, and their state Supreme Court quoted from them saying, we must resist this imposition on our state sovereignty. And there were meetings held throughout Milwaukee where they were handing out handbills saying, stand for our state sovereignty against this federal government that is oppressing black Americans and not giving them a trial when they run away. They stood up for this on the grounds of what? Their states. Now, I realize what I just told you is not cartoonish. Like, well, states want slavery, and the federal government is all nice people. It's not because it's real. That's the real history. That's what I specialize in. I specialize in teaching that. Now, okay, what would blacks lose if there was secession in the U.S. today? Well, given that the 15th Amendment is actually being enforced today, it would be very interesting to see states actually try to oppress blacks again when they are 30% of the electorate in some cases. But let's think about the wonders the federal drug war has done for all kinds of people, right? Many people who are a huge number of people incarcerated. I mean, we can go on. We all know the dreary statistics. What if we had a place in the country where we decided not to do that? Well, that would be a step forward, I think. And then secondly, how many vulnerable black kids are frankly, and I'm going to lose people, are frankly manipulated into joining the military, where they then wind up screwed up forever. And wait for your life. I personally know a guy. I'm the godfather of one of his kids, and we're close. And he was a Marine recruiter for years. And he told me, he's black, and he told me, he said, the tactics I used on these kids were reprehensible. Because they would come to me and say, you know, I'm having second thoughts about this. And I would lie right to their faces and say, you know, you can't. You're going to get in trouble if you don't enlist. Wow. Okay, that's going on. Nobody even knows about that. So, yeah, huge, big benefits that everybody's getting from the federal government. I don't buy it. All right, about the Mr. Jin, about the kid on the playground. Well, I guess I'm just a little bit more concerned about the situation that I see a lot, which is the 49 kids who are terrorizing that one. Sometimes just us to see justice and to see peace in society simply means if we have an irreconcilable difference, instead of just saying the majority must rule and rule, how about we say, F that. How about I rule me, you rule you, and we try and make that work. And then finally, with Ms. Stein, these are good arguments that she makes, and they deserve better than my quick reply. But the argument is that in large multicultural societies, there'll be a kind of equilibrium that's created among the different cultural groups. But it's not clear that is how it always works out. It seems that, to the contrary, they wind up degenerating into squabbling tribes, each of which is trying to get some portion of something that the state is distributing. The state divides people along that basis. It gets us to think of each other as being belonging to this group or that group. It intensifies differences between people. And I would ask, why would Stalin have mixed deliberately ethnic Russians into the Baltic states? Was that so that they could enjoy the gifts of diversity? Or was it instead to discombobulate their societies so they could never organize against it? Anyway, thank you all.
Remarks on our floor this evening.
So 23-4.
Okay, so by a vote of 48-23-4, the motion carries.
All right, everybody, that's that. Remember, the whole thing's at tomwoods.com/911. Let's say a quick word about another listener who's created, in this case, two websites. LibertyAndThings.com is an e-commerce site that promotes libertarian messages, economics, and philosophy by creating eye-catching artwork, apparel, mugs, and other gear. So check out libertyandthings.com if you want the world to know where you stand on things. Secondly, how about this? HazlittExplained.com. Hazlitt, of course, H-A-Z-L-I-T-T. HazlittExplained.com, where you can get the author's free ebook that summarizes the key points in Hazlitt's book, Economics in One Lesson. So these are both very valuable sites that you will want to check out, libertyandthings.com and HazlittExplained.com. Support a fellow listener by checking out one or both of those. And, of course, I will link to both of those at tomwoods.com/911. I'm not going to tell you about all the bonuses you get when you get your web hosting through my link, because you already know that. I mean, you get free publicity on my show. That alone makes it worthwhile. Not to mention all the other good stuff, so I'm not going to talk about that. Instead, I'm going to say, go to tomwoods.com/publicity and find out how you can be as fortunate as the creator of these two websites who just got this wonderful shout-out for them here on my show. All right, we are really close. I am signing the contracts today for the venue for the 1,000th episode event in Orlando on September 9th. It's a Saturday. You gotta be there. I will have an Eventbrite link to sign up. I'm not even charging admission, right? All you have to do is exist. You don't have to pay any money. You just have to be, and you can get in. It's going to be great. Make your plans. Even if you're coming from out of town, look, Orlando's a wonderful place to spend a weekend. What's the matter with you? You can spend the whole weekend doing all kinds of fun things, and then join me for the highlight of the weekend, of course, that night, Saturday night. I've got Tom DiLorenzo and Michael Malice already lined up as special guests. Man, do I have a great MC in mind. I hope he accepts. So anyway, that's all I have to say. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.